It is a pleasure to be here this morning. Emma, thank you very much for the invitation. Emma has been giving me some context on the week that you all are having and the wonderful opportunity actually to rotate around and hear different presentations and push your thinking around a bit, which is something that very busy managers and leaders and organizations just don't spend enough time doing. I work with a lot of executives who are so busy that they are a bit detached from their own thinking. And we forget sometimes that an important part of the learning cycle that enables us to grow is the ability to reflect, the ability to take some time out, the ability to put new ideas into your head, to incubate those ideas, to reflect on them, and to push your thinking around. So I applaud you all for taking the opportunity to do that this week. And here's hoping that this session will also contribute to that objective. My name is Harold Hillman, and I'm the managing director of a company called Sigmoy Curve Consulting Group. I'm based in New Zealand. This is not a New Zealand accent, but I am a proud Kiwi. I have lived in New Zealand since 2003. I came over to work with the initial executive team with Fonterra, and I thought I was coming over for 3 years and then head back over to the U.S. where I would launch my own business. But I tell you what, New Zealand is a compelling proposition. It really is, in terms of all of those things that just meant a difference, made a difference to me at a point in time in my life where, in some respects, I felt like I was still searching for a bit of purpose, and New Zealand has certainly helped me find that. So I became a citizen in 2008 and intend to spend the rest of my life here in this beautiful land. I am going to talk on the subject of authenticity today. It's a topic that is near and dear to my heart. In 2013, I wrote a book called The Imposter Syndrome. And the imposter syndrome was really, the intent behind that book was to get people talking about something that is fairly common amongst all of us. For people who have high achievement need and a high drive, high aspiration, you know that your career runway, you got a lot of runway in front of you. So there's a whole lot of potential in terms of where you can grow. And people who have a high achievement need and a high drive actually experience this thing called imposter syndrome. Imposter syndrome being where somebody may come up to us and say, have you considered this opportunity? It's a bit bigger, it's broader, it takes you away from what you might consider your sweet spot, but I think you've got all the makings for that, and you start this dialogue in your head around, you know, am I really the right person for this? Can I really do that? I'm much, you know, this is a safer place for me to be. Should I back myself and step into that void where it's a bit ambiguous and a bit uncertain? We all have to face into that every now and then. Sometimes when we go into that void, we don't back ourselves. And that's what happens with imposter syndrome, where all of a sudden, the internal critic, I make a distinction between an internal coach and an internal critic that we carry around in our mind, and it's part of who we are, basically. And the critic is that voice that sometimes kicks in when we have to push into something that's going to require us to step away from sort of that sense of security in those things that we do well. But we all know that that's one of the paradoxes in life, of course. And that is, you're not going to grow without stretch. And stretch is where you really have to back yourself. So I wrote a book about imposter syndrome because I wanted to normalize what is a very common syndrome. But, you know, 75% of you all in this audience will experience it at some point in your career. But we all think that no one else can relate to it, so we don't talk about it. And it's that space of vulnerability where we have to let go of something that is, you know, tangible and real, and we have to step into something that's a bit unknown, and the ability to really back yourself in that realm. And then in 2015, I wrote a book called Fitting and Standing Out that really broadened the whole focus around what it means to be an authentic leader. My definition of leader is not that you lead a team or that you have direct reports. My definition of leadership is making a contribution, having influence, and you don't have to have a team to be a leader. It is about influence. It ultimately is about perspective. So your influence is attached to your voice, which carries your perspective. And sometimes when we join organizations, we start turning the volume down on what we feel we were brought in to do. We start to just turn the volume down a bit, and to the point where sometimes we have put ourselves on mute. And that's not a really good place to be. It's an unhealthy place to be when, in fact, you stop giving what you thought you came on board to give, which is your perspective. And when you stop giving your perspective, it's a bad place to be, actually. It's not sustainable, certainly. I lived a very personal story around the whole notion of imposter syndrome. And with Hillary Clinton running for president this year, it sort of conjures up significant memories of 1992 for me. In 1992, Bill Clinton was running for president, and in that year, all of the U.S. presidential candidates vowed that if they were elected in 1992, that one of their first orders of business would be to remove the ban on gay citizens in the U.S. being able to serve openly in the U.S. military. The ban had been in place for decades. Prior to World War II, it was illegal and a criminal offense to be gay in the U.S. military, so gay soldiers who were outed were imprisoned. And then after World War II, it was deemed a psychiatric disorder. And so if you were outed in the military as a gay person, you would then be discharged with a medical psychiatric diagnosis. In 1973, the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality as a psychiatric disorder. So it took away the military's last bastion. The only rationale that they could basically use was that somehow gay soldiers, gay airmen, gay personnel in the Marines or the Navy would somehow compromise the esprit and the decorum, sort of compromise what we call esprit de corps in the military. And that had really been the last rationale. It just wasn't adding up for a lot of citizens in the U.S. The military budgets were shrinking. The number of personnel going into the military were shrinking. There were a lot of gay people wanting to serve in the military, an increasing number of straight servicemen and women were also going, what's up with the ban? So it became a big issue in 1992, and Bill Clinton was elected. And sure enough, the day after his inauguration in January of 1993, he established a commission with the objective to lift the ban. And I was a captain serving in the U.S. military at the time. I had been in the military at that point for 5 years. I was on the faculty at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, in Colorado. Beautiful place. I had been in the military for 5 years, had served an initial tour of duty as chief of mental health at Myrtle Beach Air Force Base, and then was invited to teach at the Air Force Academy, and I just thought that was a tremendous opportunity. And in 1993, General Hosmer, the superintendent of the academy, called me into his office, and he said to me, Captain Hillman, because of your outstanding service, in terms of I had the year before won what was called Outstanding Military Educator of the Year at the Academy. I was honored to have that citation. And he said, look, based on this distinction, we would like for you to go to Washington, D.C. and be sequestered for 3 months and serve on this commission to determine if gay people could serve openly in the U.S. military. And look, I was honored. I mean, this was just like such to sit in front of a three-star general who was telling you that he was sending me on behalf of the Air Force to join 40 other officers and enlisted personnel who would spend 3 months to make a very important decision. I was honored and I was terrified. was absolutely terrified. I was terrified because 5 years earlier, I had lied on my application in joining the U.S. Air Force. I knew that it was illegal to be gay in the U.S. military, but I had lied all my life about being gay, so I just thought it'd just be another lie. I didn't anticipate that that lie was going to take me into the eye of an existential storm. I just thought it was one of those things where, you know, I would just sort of lie. I'd gotten used to it. I had deduced early in my life that it wasn't, just didn't feel cool to be gay. It caused a lot of consternation in other folks. It caused a lot of sort of, didn't like the vibe that was coming back to me on the other side of that. And as a child, I was very intuitive around that stuff. I just realized that the less people think that I'm gay, the more people seem to just be less anxious around me. My being gay seemed to evoke a lot of anxiety in people. And some people, it evoked ire. You know, there were people who were just sort of offended at the very nature of who you might be because of who you are. And that's a daunting proposition when you're a kid and you're trying to determine, you know, how best to sort of fit in that respect. That's why I wrote a book called Fitting In, Standing Out, because I fit in too well. You know, my objective early in my life was to turn my persona down in order to fit in and be accepted and to be deemed acceptable. That was really my objective, was if I didn't see any consternation on the other side of me, then I figured that I was being a good citizen and that it was my role to turn down anything that would potentially offend or, you know, sort of offend the sensitivities or the sensibilities of other folks. And so I had just assumed that that was how I was going to live my life as a closeted gay man. I was married with two daughters, and that was just going to be my reality, which was the reality of a lot of gay people who were born. You know, I was born in 1955, I'm 61. I just deduced at that time. I applaud gay folks who are coming out in the year 2016 who feel that sense of being whole earlier in their lives. Now, I don't have any regrets about my life. I have two beautiful daughters and I have two beautiful grandsons. And so this is not a story about regret. It's just a story to basically emphasize that sometimes you can go too far in fitting in, and I did that, and I went into the military, and I thought, okay. It was the first time I'd ever had to actually lie about who I was on an application. So question 13 on the Department of Defense, U.S. Department of Defense, military application, question 13, have you ever initiated or voluntarily engaged in any homosexual behavior? That was question 13, yes or no. On the job application, can you imagine that on the job application? Can you imagine that question if you're straight? Can you imagine that question on the job application in reverse to sort of signify, holy crap, what in the world is that? And then beneath that, you know, it was, if yes, please provide details. Well, we were not going there at all. I just thought, lie, lie. I didn't know that the lie was going to take me into that storm, and so off I went to Washington, D.C. to now sit in a panel. I was a captain. I was a flunky. I was a doer. I didn't have any voice. I was there to help write the training policy for whatever the decision would be, whatever the panel was chaired by three generals and an admiral. They were in charge, and they made it clear to us on the very first day as they pulled us all together. We would be there for about 3 months. It ended up not being quite 3 months or so, because they made it clear to us on the very first day, this ban is not going to be lifted. We have absolutely no respect for this new gay sympathizer president called Bill Clinton, and you'll love this. And they certainly didn't have tolerance for his, their words, lesbian wife Hillary. Isn't it hysterical? Here we are in 2016, and it just feels like it's all come all the way around full circle in that respect there. But the Clintons were a real threat. And then the admiral and the three generals made it clear, this isn't going down under our watch. So we knew, certainly within 48 hours, that the ban wasn't going to be lifted. It was really only about a month or so later in a consultative back and forth between the head panel and, at the time, Secretary of Defense Colin Powell, that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was generated. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was born, conceived in February of 1993, but was not announced until December of 1993, because there was a wrestle going back and forth in terms of what it was going to be, but the military just wasn't going to lift the ban. So I sat there for 3 months as part of this panel, just in a big room around all of us sitting around, and I listened to people come in and tell testimony, give testimony around it was a consultative process. So there were groups that were pro-gay people serving in the military who came in to present research and evidence that, you know, morale and esprit would not be compromised. And there were groups who did not want gay people serving in the military. And they came in with all kinds of heinous research and findings. And they were presenting evidence that gay people were psychiatrically twisted and ill, despite the fact that it had been removed as a psychiatric disorder, and that gay people were ethically and psychopathically inclined. They came in with a lot of evidence that suggested that these sort of vilifying and putting around the persona of who gay people were, this notion that somehow they would bring the whole military down. And there I sat as a decorated officer. There I sat as a decorated officer, selected for my outstanding service. And I sat there and listened to that testimony for 3 months. And, you know, it begins to eat away at your integrity. When your silence perpetuates something that you know not to be true, but it's much easier to just fit in. It's just easier to just turn off part of your persona. That wasn't easy. That was quite daunting. They were no longer talking about hypothetical gay people. They were talking about me. It was personal at that point. And it was real searing. And I tell you what, when the only comical relief in that whole scenario was, I almost had my 15 minutes of fame in that scenario. The admiral had just had it. He was real cantankerous, and he had just had it. A group came in and said, a group petitioning on behalf of gay people being able to serve openly came in to present evidence that between 13 and 18% of the military was already gay. So, like, what's the big deal? It's already, and the admiral had it after they left. And he banged the table vigorously, and he said, I can tell you that I've been in the military 35 years, and I have never served with anyone gay. And I sat as close to him as you are. Oh, I just wanted to reach my hand out to him and go, well, girlfriend, this is your lucky day. Decided not to do that. But I tell you what, it was quite searing. It was quite searing when we all got back to our respective bases. When I got back to the academy, the superintendent pulled over 1,000 people together to award me the Meritorious Service Medal. For distinguished service to the United States. It was a big, big deal. And I tell you what, I'd never felt more hollow standing on that stage. It was the first time that a scripture had resonated with me really deeply. First time. It's from the New Testament. It's what... For what shall it profit you to gain the whole world and yet lose your own soul? Is there anything worth more than your soul? I didn't think so. You don't appreciate something until you feel it slipping away. And that's certainly the thing that galvanized me, is that I felt like I had sold my soul, that I had turned off my whole persona for the sake of fitting in. I left that experience, went back, had a very personal, very tough, the most difficult conversation I'd ever had with my wife. My daughters were young then. We would have that conversation later. And I embarked then on this journey and this quest to become a whole person, become a whole person. When my daughters were in their 20s, they said, we can have the conversation with you now that we couldn't have with you when we were 11 and 9. And what we want to tell you is that we could sense immediately that we were connecting to a whole person. And we like having a whole father who's not compartmentalized. For me, it was turning off my persona. We all do it in the interest and in the quest to fit in. We all make judgments on what needs to go. You know, I've had people turn off their laugh. A guy was told, your laugh is ignorant. Your laugh is ignorant. I would prefer you not laugh. It turns off the clients. Don't laugh. Seriously, don't laugh. Your laugh is not intelligent. Can you imagine that? A laugh is attached to the limbic system. It's neurological. So for 2 years, this is what he told me, 2 years he sat in meetings, and his major objective was not to laugh. He couldn't give of himself. He couldn't connect. He was so focused. He was so focused on containing this aspect. People who are divergent thinkers who are just naturally inquisitive. You just ask why. It's just how you're wired. It's how you think. You like to think in terms of what's possible, possibilities. But in some organizations, asking why is a threat. Why can be a very threatening question when you're sitting over the social order in an organization, because why implies that there might be a different way of doing things. And we learn very quickly in some organizations, don't ask why. Even if you were brought in to ask why, that's the thing. We get brought in. We get told when we're being interviewed, like, we want you to come in and disturb the peace in here. Get in here and change the thinking. We don't think broadly enough. We don't think innovatively enough. Get in here and change the thinking. And you get in there and you start poking at the thinking. And your boss will reel you in and reach for the volume button and start turning that volume down. You know, you're on an 8 right now. We need to turn you down to about a 6. That's going to work, you know. And while we're here, let's change you from channel 3 to channel 4 and get that. Let's get that adjusted as well. Now, look, going in, you sometimes realize you do need to. Some people don't need it as loud. Some people need it on channel 4 versus channel 3. You get in there and you realize, okay, you know, they like a lot of detail in this organization. I need to, like, go into that space, or they're real conceptual here. Every now and then we do need to get on a different channel, but, you know, that's one thing. But it's another thing in terms of just turn off your persona. Like, stop thinking. Don't think. I don't pay you to think. I know I told you that when I interviewed you. That's how people make their contribution. When you bring people in, leadership is about influence, and influence is through perspective. So if you start turning your perspective down, you're losing the ability to influence. And if you get to that point on the continuum where, you know, it's just in the interest of what the company needs, I tell you what, that's what wakes you up. When you get to the end of that continuum where it says strain on you, that's 2:45 in the morning and you're waking up and you're staring at the ceiling and you're trying to get back to sleep. And it's 2:45 in the morning, and your conscience is sort of pushing at you. The beautiful thing about the conscience, the beautiful thing about the psyche is that it won't let you sleep if there's business undone. So if you're waking up at 2:30 in the morning because there's some undone business, that's what's churning around in there. That's your sense of, am I in a space where I am doing and being who I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to be, and that requires me on occasion to, hey, there's a stronger gravitational pull towards fitting in. We help people in through formal induction and orientation programs, and we assign them buddies and all of those kinds of things. But we, you know, we get in here. Get in quickly, get in quietly, just get in here. Quietly is better. There are some organizations that equate quiet with effectiveness. You know, a quiet team is a good team. A quiet team is a healthy team. You want to be very concerned if you have a quiet team. You want to be very concerned if you have a quiet team when nobody's poking, nobody's asking why, nobody's getting under assumptions that you, it's just, I think we need to be quiet. Now, most of us will not be quiet over matters of, you know, we're not going to break the law. We're not going to engage in the ethical impropriety or anything like that. But most of the time, it's just sort of like turn your voice down. Just turn your voice down. Just turn it down. Just a little bit more. And before you know it, you've put yourself on mute. Whether it's a laugh or an aspect of your persona, you start reaching for your own mute button. The way you think is irritating to someone. A woman told me once that her manager told her, you're too perky, I need you to be, you're too perky. Turn down your joy. Just turn it down. Just turn it down. I'm a miserable person. I don't like joyful people around me. Just turn it down. Sometimes we ask people to turn things down on a matter of preference, not principle. When I was in the military, the principle, certainly in the U.S., certainly at a time and point in U.S. history where it was sort of an honor to serve your country. It's considered just one of those things. And people considered that a principle. The preference was you've got to do it straight. President Obama lifted the ban on gays being able to serve openly. He lifted that ban in 2011 without even any fanfare associated with it. The U.S., the military, everybody was ready for it. We get it. We turn ourselves down. What is it to then push through? What is it to push through and to stand out? A young man recently told me that he confronted two of his, he's in his 20s, and he confronted two of his peers in their 40s on a team, first woman on the team. Every time she went out of the room, the three older guys had a go at her. Real inappropriate stuff. And the young guy, 22, had enough. And after a couple of weeks or so of just watching this happen, his heart was palpitating. Because these three guys are, you know, I mean, they're twice his age. They've been there a while. You know, he considers them, they've helped him. But he's just said to them, I can't do this. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this anymore. He told them, I feel sick. I feel sick when you all do that. It's not right. I'm not going to do it. And he left. He walked out. That's what it feels like sometimes when you have to stand out on a matter of what you consider to be principle, where the social order appears to be just because everyone else is doing it or no one else is saying anything. And he went back to his little area, and within the hour, he told me that two of the came to him, independent, he just came to him, put their arm around him, and thanked him. Thank you for helping us be better. Thank you for helping us be better. It's one of the things that enables you to stand out when you want to push against the grain, and it's about who we can be. It's what we can do better. It's who we can be. It's about purpose. It's about vision, and that's inspiration. And when you're pushing through the social order, you give people a sense of what's really important. Who can we be? We can be better than this. We can absolutely be better than this. And sometimes we don't come to that realization until somebody just stands up and just says it. You ever been that person to raise your hand in a meeting because you aren't tracking with what's going on, and you ask a question and you go, you worry, like, should I ask this question? No one else is asking this question. There's 200 people in here. No one else is asking this question. And then you ask the question, and then you get out on a break, and 10 people come up to you and thank you for asking the question. Thank you for asking that question. I was lost too. Silence is not golden, people. You want to get real concerned if you've put yourself on mute or if you're reaching for the mute button for people who work for you. The sense of engagement is really, the sense of engagement is in the middle portion there, Brené Brown, the renowned clinical social worker in the States. She did a TED talk called The Power of Vulnerability, and I recommend you all see that TED talk, and she talks about the wholehearted as people who are comfortable with vulnerability, which means that you're going to take a chance and you're going to push into discomfort every now and then. People who struggle with vulnerability often will live on the extremes. And so if you struggle with vulnerability and you can't be imperfect, then you're probably going to hide in some cases, and that's what happens with imposter syndrome. Or you lock down. You lock down. And that is, I know I'm wrong, but I've already said it, so I've got to stick with it. You ever been in that uncomfortable position where because you've laid it down and now you realize, holy crap, but you now have to sort of, that's called lockdown, where I'm too vulnerable to actually change my mind because I'm worried that people will perceive that I'm imperfect, which is what real strong leaders are. We're imperfect, and we have that. The ability to give and take, the ability to flex and to bend. I talk about the raw ingredients of vulnerability, four essentials that are required if you're going to live in that wholehearted zone on that continuum there. And the first essential is trust, and that is, I trust you enough that I don't have to be perfect. I trust you enough that I can come into your office and ask for help. I can ask you to help me think. I hire direct reports. I hire people. I hire them to work for me because of their thinking. And then when they get on the team, I don't let them think. They come in and they start to think, and I just reach for their volume button. It's like, no, I don't have time for that right now. And if you don't, if you have to, some people wear a mental model that I'm the boss and I have to come up with the answer. And that's a precarious mental model to wear as a leader, particularly when you hire people to help you think. You got to let them help you. So this thing is, if you feel that you have to be right and you have to be the one that comes up with the solution, then you're going to be basically sending a vibe to other people, which is, I don't need you. Your participation is optional as far as I'm concerned because I'm perfect. I don't need other people, and that's going to get you into lockdown. Well, that's going to get you into hide real quickly in that respect there. So in the first instance around this wholeheartedness is the ability to be comfortable with imperfection. It's only a matter of hours before your next mistake. It's only a matter of hours. Are you comfortable with that? Is that okay? Affiliation. People come to work each day to be needed. It's a basic human need to be needed. We join organizations, we join families, we join clubs, we join churches, we join anything we join because of this sense of affiliation. There's something going on in there that I want to be a part of. So those of us who walked into our own companies without being products of acquisition, but we walked in voluntarily to a company saying, I'd like to be a part of you. It's validating for us when people need us. And sometimes we don't need people. That's the vibe we send. I don't need you, particularly if I need to be perfect, because if I need to be perfect, of course I don't need you. And even though I hired you, I don't really need you. So the vibe you get off of me is, there's nothing. There's nothing connecting there. I don't need my peers. I don't need my, sometimes I need my boss because I have to need my boss, but that's it. But others, absolutely not. People come to work to be needed. It's a big source of validation. It helps. That's what engagement is all about. Forget big budgets around engagement. Just need somebody. You want to get an engaged team or engaged workforce, just need them. Let them help you. Let them help you think. Let your team help you think. That's all they want to do. But if you have this need to be the one, it's going to be a long haul. In that respect, it's not rewarding for you, and it's certainly not rewarding for them. And then there's affirmation. For some people, the validation that they get at work each day is their only source of validation. And some people come to work because it's the only place where they feel a real sense of tangible impact. Sometimes they aren't getting it at home or in their personal sphere. They come to work because they want to be needed. Sometimes we have trouble saying thank you. Just thank you. Thank you. I'm not going to say thank you if I feel the need to be perfect, so why should I thank you? So there's often a correlation between how much affirmation you get from a person and their belief that you've actually helped them. Because if I'm not going to let you help me, then why should I thank you? And people go thankless across the day, across the week. Jack Welch used a wonderful analogy when he was running GE. And that analogy was our teams, you know, a garden. They need nutrients. They need good soil. They need sunlight. They need rain. An opportunity. They need an opportunity to know, am I making a difference? It's a human need. And then finally, growth. Growth. Are you comfortable stretching yourself? You can't ask someone else to take a chance if you don't take a chance. We watch your actions more than we listen to your words. Your actions weigh far more than your words. And so if you're asking other people to take a chance, take a risk, push themselves, you've got to be willing to do so. Those are the raw ingredients of vulnerability associated with living in that range called the wholehearted. I want to just, in my remaining time, take you through the seven elements of authenticity. And these were based on 200-plus interviews that I did in, for the second book, where I just sat down with folks like you, and I, in what was, you know, an hour-long conversation, and I would just simply say, I'd like you to get a person in your mind, could be someone at work, could be someone at home, who you consider to be an authentic person, your definition of authentic. And people would do this, and I would then we'd get into a conversation with the person, and that was really what my interviews were all about. Just tell me about this person. Tell me about this person. And it's interesting because the word authenticity implies unique or rare. Something's authentic. We like having something authentic because it is rare. There's a good feeling associated with it because it's distinctive. So we do have this common notion that an authentic person is distinctive, rare. But when I sit down and talk with people about an authentic person, you're all describing the same thing, which is we all have the same notion in our mind. And what I wanted to do in my work with the imposter syndrome and with fitting and standing out was to make the case that you don't have to be a great leader. This isn't reserved for iconic leaders, world leaders on the grand scale of things. You're authentic to someone every day. And authenticity requires that you be wholehearted and that you be comfortable with needing other people, that you be comfortable with imperfection, that you be comfortable putting yourself in stretch and putting yourself on a learning curve as well. And here are the seven elements associated with authenticity. The first one is positivity. Positivity. You see that glass half empty or half full? That's the old test, you know, optimism, pessimism, etc. Well, we do live on it's called explanatory style in psychological terms. I'm a clinical psychologist from my earlier career. And so explanatory style is this continuum, and on one end is pessimism, and on the other end is optimism. Optimism tends to correlate with more effective leadership in the sense that the energy is just a bit more compelling. So you just want to be across this. Pessimism is not a bad thing. You need pessimists at a table as well. Pessimists tend to think in terms of what's probable. So they tend to move a little bit slower because they are just really thinking about all the things and the factors that are there versus optimists who think in terms of what's possible, and so they surge real fast, and there's an energy associated with that. So there is. It's just being mindful that sometimes people do want to be fueled. But it's more than optimism and pessimism in that sense of what's possible. Because that's what people are talking about when they talk about being inspired. That word comes up a lot. When they're sitting with someone who's authentic, they're inspired. And what's going on is that do you leave people, so particularly someone who's come into you and made a mistake? Number one, can you have someone come in to see you who's made a mistake? It's hard to go in and talk to a perfect boss when you've made a mistake. It's really daunting. Because if you're a perfect person, you don't have empathy. You can't understand. You can't relate. You can't connect. You don't know what that's like. So when a person is you know, tortured themselves for 2 days because they have to come in and finally have that conversation with you about the mistake they've made. Can you leave them motivated? This can't happen again. This just absolutely can't happen again. Let's be clear about that. But do you leave them believing in themselves? Do they believe you believe in them? One of the most engaging things you can ever do with someone who has come in to tell you about a mistake, and their heart is just palpitating. That's how daunting it is for them. Just tell them a story about when you made a mistake. Take them back 10 years. Tell them a story. In the first instance, just give them something to connect to, another person. Watch the impact. Watch the connection. You can relate. You can understand this. I get it. This can't happen again, but thank God you can relate. Thank God. When people stop coming in to talk to you about concerns and issues and just help me think through something, you may be sending off a vibe that, hey, it's not very reinforcing to do that. Do you leave people hopeful, believing in themselves? Are you always picking and poking and picking at stuff? You know, that's wrong. Look at that. Another mistake. That's bad. Why can't you do that? Here it goes again. And all of a sudden, you wonder why when you walk in the room, people go like this. Because you've become a conditioned stimulus for negativity. People crave a sense of where they've made a difference, even if humility kicks in. Do people associate your leadership with positivity? I'm not talking about sunshine and roses and dancing through the office and all of that. I'm just talking about, do you leave people feeling good about themselves? That's all I'm talking about. They come to work each day to make a difference. Do you tell them that they make a difference? One of the most powerful things you can do with a direct report is to say, thank you for helping me think about that. I hadn't seen that. I hadn't thought about it that way. I just hadn't thought about it. But this has been beautiful, actually, because you helped me to see it in a different way. Thank you for that. You hired that person to help you think, but then we don't let them help us. And that's all they want to do. You don't require a budget for engagement. All you got to do is just thank somebody every now and then. I had a guy going into a new company, and he brought one of his new team members in. He had been there for 2 weeks, and he brought one of his two team members in, and he sat her down, and he went to thank her for the work she had done on this project over the last 2 weeks, and she ran out of the room in tears. So he, like, thought, holy crap, what has happened? And she came back a little bit late, and she just said, I'm sorry, I just haven't heard that in a long time. She was shocked. She was shocked. She hadn't heard thank you. It doesn't require a lot in terms of being an authentic person to someone else. I'll thank you if I'm not worried about having to be perfect. That's what leadership is about, real. Do people experience you as real? Are you genuine? When I ask people to tell me about an authentic person, they say, this is a person who's real. They're just real. You don't need a decoder. You don't need all this big, fancy MBA words and all of just. A senior executive told me recently that he had an out-of-body experience where he could hear himself talking to an audience. And he had all these hyperfalutin MBA jargon terms, everything with 5 or 6 syllables. And he went like, holy crap, what have I become? I don't even talk in a way that people can connect to me. I've become some walking lexicon. And because I'm, you know, wear a bit of rank, nobody's going to ask me, so I'm up there talking. I sound like Charlie Brown's teacher. I'm 61, so Charlie Brown. Anyone know what I'm talking about? Charlie Brown's teacher. That's what you sound like when people don't perceive of you as being real. Womp, 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 womp. That's what Charlie Brown's teacher sounds like. Right? This is real. And that is, if I'm one person, I don't have to then figure out, now, who do I need to be today at this group? And wait a minute, I'm going to this group tomorrow, so now I've got to be like, now I've got to say this. Every now and then you adjust your message to whatever audience you're talking to, but I'm talking about, like, are you consistent? Consistency is the major driver around perceived trust. And that is, wow, you seem to be two or three different people depending on who you are with. People assess that in terms of being real. Edge. Edge. I'm looking out at some edge. I see edge in the audience there. Sometimes you can just see it. And it's poignant, and it is just vibrant. It's compelling. It doesn't have to do with extroversion or being the loudest person or the funkiest person or anything like that. You can be quite still and quite introverted. You can be quite quiet and have all the edge in the world when you say it. It means something. It's that 21-year-old. It's that 21-year-old. It's Malala Yousafzai at the age of 11, the young Pakistani girl who, when she was 14, was shot in the head by some Taliban thugs who wanted her dead because she dared to question. At the age of 11, she dared to question why it was that people had a problem with girls going to school. She couldn't figure out why people would be so riled up against her getting an education. So she started a blog at 11 in Pakistan. And we sometimes worry about whether or not we should go in and just have that conversation with our boss about something. And here's an 11-year-old girl at the age of 14, shot, left for dead. But the good news is that she survived and she galvanized the world around that cause. Sometimes your edge is quite compelling, and you don't know if it'll make a difference until you just push into it. And that edge is often associated with, I'm just going to raise my hand, and I'm going to make this point. When you have edge, and when you're able to push through, when you're wholehearted, you're not waking up a whole lot at 2:30 in the morning. This isn't about necessarily being the most colorful person in the room. This is a person who, when you speak, because it does matter. Do people know that things matter to you? Are there exclamation marks behind some of the things that you, when it is a matter of principle now? The standard you walk by is the standard you accept. Edge makes a big difference. When people tell me about an authentic person, they usually are talking about a person who is not afraid to push in. Vulnerability. The paradox of life is that we don't grow without getting comfortable with vulnerability, but it scares the hell out of us. It scares the hell out of us. You've got to be real confident with yourself when you're vulnerable. Here's the thing about being vulnerable. It usually connects you with other people. Most people know when you're taking a chance and pushing yourself out of your comfort zone. There's this thing called human empathy. We empathize with people when they push themselves. We empathize. We know what that feels like. So if you're sometimes sitting there going, should I just take the stand? Should I just take this chance? Should I just push myself? People connect with that. They know what it's like. There's something wonderful about the human condition when it comes to vulnerability. We can relate to it, and we lean into it. And vulnerability can be quite compelling. So don't put too much pressure on yourself to be this Superman or Superwoman. Imperfection can serve you well. It can take a lot of pressure off of you. If you just concede that there's just, you know, it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to let other people help you think. It's okay to let other people help you build things. That energy, I think, speaks for itself. When people talk about an encounter with an authentic person, there's a sense of what's being unleashed. So this is a person who is able to, just in their thinking, so help me think. You'll see it when you let people help you think. I find on dysfunctional teams very often, peers don't It's not a lot of affirmation. View the sense around energy. If you just walk into somebody's office and just say, look, I'm noodling over something. I'm troubled by something. I can't get my head around it fully. I know you've had these experiences. Can you help me think this through? Just help me think. I'm going to lay it out. Watch the energy. Watch the energy. As opposed to somebody wandering into your office going, hey, I hear you're going to be leading this project, and I've had this experience over the last 5 years or so. I just thought I would drop by and see if I could offer any. And it's like, boom, not needed. Not needed. Sometimes we don't need people. That energy exchange there is about comfort with vulnerability. Integrity, my story hopefully exemplifies integrity. I equate soul with integrity. That's my personal word for it. And that sense of being able to really be able to, again, one person. It's hard to ask people to connect with you when they don't get a real sense that you're connected with yourself. And so integrity is one of those things that is just very important to people. And then finally, I'm sorry, apologize, I went forward too quickly. Connections. I had a coaching call this morning with a very compelling leader who's leading a digital, laboratory, actually, for his organization. And he's galvanizing. He's just absolutely galvanizing in terms of his ability. He has gotten, probably in the last 3 months, just 3 month window of time, the executive team and the board across this laboratory that they're going to create. And it's largely fed by his energy. It's no different than Malala Yousafzai. It's that edge. It's that sense of this is important. It is a matter of principle. Sometimes when you push through, and when you stand out, all of a sudden you find that there are like four or five other folks who are standing around you. And now they're involved in the conversation, and authentic people tend to be those who connect others. So these are the elements of authenticity, and I'm sorry, I forget where I put my clicker there. I want to leave this up here for just a second, and this is just to get us into some final Q&A with the person next to you, sitting next to you, who may be a stranger to you, so this will require some vulnerability because you have to be imperfect to do this. Which of those seven elements do you think, maybe I've got some work to do? Have that conversation with the person next to you, and I'll bring you back in two minutes to have that. Where do you think you've got some work to do? All right. Okay, let me bring you back. See what, See what energy is created when you don't need to be perfect, where you're able to like point up there and talk about some things? This is what leaders do. And when I'm working with leaders and when I'm coaching leaders, I work with a lot of leaders in my work as an executive coach and in my work with teams. And my focal point is that authenticity is a hugely important construct that sits across important leadership. You can walk into a room sometimes and just see a team that's really locked into the sense of it is unsafe here to be imperfect. And I tell you what, that's a different energy than when everybody is just letting it fly in the interest of what they are creating, because we can build something important. Any questions? Any questions? I have 3 minutes, I think, to any questions that I can answer for you. Yes. Yeah. Was no? Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. For the kids, what are you coaching them in?
Just sport.
So kids would be at, how old are they? Okay, so by now, it's usually around 6 or 7 or so, where the internal coach or critic is pretty defined in your psyche. Internal coach, internal critic, and that is, are you inclined just when you push yourself, like in, you know, any competition, vulnerability, do you hear the coach's voice? Like, go ahead, back yourself, do it, go for it. That sense of energy, that sense surge versus, maybe not, you can often see it in kids. It's defined usually by the age of 6 or so, and we carry that into adulthood. And so one of the things that I would say is infuse that sense of coach, infuse that sense of what they can do. Don't take it for granted. Very often people have that balance. Remember, people with high drive and achievement, their critic typically is louder than their coach. And so what you want to do, it's a beautiful thing when your coach's voice at least comes up. Critic is not a bad thing, by the way. Critic just says, don't make a fool of yourself. And so the critic is going like, so you're less likely to make a fool of yourself if you just stay where you are. Right? That's the critic. Some rationale there. The coach is going, go for it. So as a coach, and I think it's a beautiful thing, as a coach, it's the coach's voice. And that is, tell people you believe in them. Tell them what they can do. Give them a sense of what the end state looks like. Remember, when people are pulling down the field, whether it be kids or adults, very often they lose perspective on the end game. Remind them what the end game is. Remind them, just believe in them. Tell them that you believe in them. Remind them what they can do. You can get a lot out of people if you just believe in them. That's all they want. Do you believe in me? One more question. Thank you for that. Thank you. Oh. I think the story is coming to an end the way it's supposed to come to an end. And that is Donald Trump, because he is unique, because he is different. People would say authentic in the sense of being real. So he stands out. But my premise under authenticity is that there's a sustainability and that positivity is associated with it. When you start turning neighbor against neighbor and religion against religion, when you start turning people, you know, breeding a suspicion around your neighbor based on how they vote or who they worship or who they love, all of those things, that's a dangerous proposition. And I do hope that I'm blessed to be able to live in, I can call myself a citizen of the United States and New Zealand. I do hope that my home country folks will validate that there is something powerful about positivity and what we can do when we pull together versus being divisive and starting to breed suspicion against each other. So here's hoping that in a couple of weeks, the world will get back to normal. Thank you all for the opportunity to be here this morning. It really makes it, I really thank you. Thank you so much.
the right.